Plucked and cleaned, he went into the canteen over the fire that Mark made in the backyard, and while he boiled, Mark had a sudden thought. He went back into the old man's bedroom, and in the far corner, where the big brass bed had once stood, he knelt and felt for the loose board. He prized the single nail that held it down with his clasp knife, and then lifted the plank. He reached down into the opening below, and brought out first a thick bundle of envelopes tied with a strip of rawhide. Mark riffled the edge of the pack, and saw that not a single envelope had been opened. They were all addressed in his own spiky hand. They had been carefully stored in this hiding place. Yet not all Mark's letters were there. The sequence ended abruptly, and Mark, checking the last letter, found it postmarked 11 months previously. Mark felt a choking sensation in the base of his throat, and the sharp sting of tears. He placed the bundle of letters aside and reached again into the opening to bring out the Mazawati tea caddy, with the picture of the grandmother in steel-rimmed spectacles on the lid. It was the old man's treasure chest. He carried the can and the bundle of letters out into the backyard, for the late afternoon light was going fast in the unlit rooms. He sat on the kitchen step and opened the tea caddy. There were 40 gold sovereigns in the leather purse. Some of them had the bearded head of Kruger, the old president of the South African Republic, the others of Edward and George. Mark slipped the purse into the inner pocket of his jacket, and in the fading light examined the rest of the old man's treasure. Photographs of Grandmother Alice as a young woman, yellowed and dog-eared with age, a wedding certificate, old newspaper clippings from the Boer War, cheap articles of women's jewellery, the same as those that Alice wore in the photographs. A medal in a presentation case, a Queen's South Africa medal with 6 bars, including those for Tugela, Ladysmith and the Transvaal campaigns. Mark's own school reports from the Ladyburg School. And then the diploma from the University College at Port Natal. These the old man valued especially, with the illiterate's awe of learning and the written word. He had sold some of his prize livestock to pay for Mark's education. He rated it that highly. Nothing in the tea caddy, apart from the sovereigns, was of any value, but it had all been precious beyond price to the old man. Carefully, Mark repacked the tin and placed it in his backpack. In the last light of day, Mark ate the stringy cockerel and the fruit, and when he rolled into his blanket on the wooden kitchen floor, he was still thinking. He knew now that the old man, wherever he had gone, had intended returning to Anders Land. He would never have left that precious hoard behind, unless that had been his intention. A boot in the ribs brought Mark awake, and he rolled over and sat up, gasping with the pain of it. "On your feet, get your arse moving, and keep it going!" It was not yet fully light, but Mark could make out the man's features. He was clean-shaven, with a heavy, smooth jaw, and his teeth seemed to have been ground down to a flat, even line, very white against the dark suntan. His head was round like a cannonball and gave the impression of vast weightiness, for he carried it low on a thick neck like a heavyweight boxer shaping up. "Up!" he repeated, and drew back the scuffed brown riding boot again. Mark came up on his feet and squared to defend himself. He found the man was shorter than he was, but he was stocky and solid, with broad, thick shoulders and the same weightiness in his frame. "This is private property. We don't want tramps hanging about." "I'm not a tramp," Mark started, but the man cut him short with a snort of brusque laughter. "You with the fancy clothes and the rolls parked at the door. You had me fooled for a moment there." "My name is Mark Anders," he said. "This land belongs to my grandfather, John Anders." He thought he saw something move in the man's eyes, a change in the set of his mouth. Doubt or worry, perhaps? He licked his lips, a quick, nervous gesture. But when he spoke, his voice was still flat and quiet. "I don't know nothing about that. All I know is this land belongs to the Ladyburg Estates now, and I'm the foreman for the company, and neither me nor the company wants you hanging around here." He paused and settled on his feet, dropping his shoulders and pushing out his heavy jaw. "And one other thing I know is I like to break a head now and then, and I haven't broken one for God knows a long time." They stared at each other, and Mark felt a sudden hot rush of anger. He wanted to take up the man's challenge, even though he realized how powerful and dangerous he was. He had the look of a killer, and the weight and the strength, but Mark felt himself coming into balance, his own shoulders dropping. His tormentor saw it also, and his relish was obvious. He smiled thinly, clenching his jaw around the smile, so that the cord stood out in his throat, swaying slightly up onto the balls of his feet. Then suddenly Mark felt revolted and sickened by the presence of violence. There had been too much of it in his life already, and there was no reason to fight now. He turned away and picked up his boots. The man watched him dress, disappointed perhaps, but ready for further confrontation. When he swung his pack up onto his shoulder, Mark asked, "What's your name?" The man answered him lightly, still keyed up for violence. "My friends call me Hobday," he said. "Hobday who?" "Just Hobday." "I won't forget it," said Mark. "You've been a real brick, Hobday." He went down the steps into the yard, and 15 minutes later, when Mark looked back from the ridge where the Ladyburg Road crossed on to its way northwards, Hobday was still standing in the kitchen yard of Andersland, watching him intently. Fred Black watched Mark come up the hill. He leaned against the rail of the dipping tank and chewed steadily on his quid of tobacco, stringy and sun-blackened and dry as a stick of chewing tobacco himself. Although he was one of John Anders' cronies, he had known Mark since he was a crawler. It was clear he did not recognise him now. Mark stopped 15 paces off and lifted his hat. "Hello, Uncle Fred," Mark greeted him, and still it was a moment before the older man let out a whoop and leapt to embrace Mark. "God, boy, they told me you'd got yourself killed in France." They sat together on the rail of the cattle pen while the Zulu herd boys drove the cattle below them through the narrow race, until they reached the ledge from which they made the wild scrambling leap into the deep, stinking chemical bath, to come up again, snorting fearfully, and swim nose up for the slope ramp beyond. "He's been dead almost a year. No, longer. Over a year now, lad. I'm sorry. I never thought to let you know. Like I said, we thought you were dead in France." "That's all right, Uncle Fred." Mark was surprised that he felt no shock. He had known it, accepted it already, but there was still the grief that lay heavy on his soul. They were both silent for a longer time, the old man beside him respecting his grief. "How did he..." Mark hesitated over the word. "How did he go?" "Well now," Fred Black lifted his hat and rubbed the bald pink pate lovingly. "It was all a bit sudden-like. He went off to poach a little biltong with Piet Greling and his son up at Sharker's Gate." Vivid memories crowded back for Mark. Sharker's Gate was the vast wilderness of area to the north, where the old man had taught him the craft of the hunter. Years before, back in 1869, it had been declared a hunting reserve, but no warden had been appointed, and the men of northern Natal and Zululand looked upon it as their private hunting reserve. On the fifth day, the old man did not come back into camp. They searched for him another 4 days, where they found him. He paused again and glanced at Mark. "You feeling all right, boy?" "Yes, I'm all right." Mark wondered how many men he had seen die, how many he had killed himself, and yet the death of one more old man could move him so. "Go on, please, Uncle Fred." "Pete said it looked like he had slipped while he was climbing a steep place, and he had fallen on his rifle and it had gone off. It hit him in the stomach." They watched the last ox plunge into the dip, and Fred Black climbed stiffly down from the pole fence. He held the small of his back for a moment. "Getting old," he grunted, and Mark fell in beside him as they started up towards the house. "Pete and his boy buried him there. He wasn't fit to bring back. He'd been in the sun 4 days. They marked the place and made a sworn statement to the magistrate when they got back to Ladyburg." Fred Black was interrupted by a cry and the sight of a female figure racing down the avenue of blue gum trees towards them, slim and young with honey-brown hair in a thick braid bouncing on her back, long brown legs and grubby bare feet beneath the skirts of the faded cheap cotton skirt. "Mark!" she cried again. "Oh, Mark!" But she was close before he recognised her. She had changed in 4 years. "Mary!" The sadness was still on Mark, but he could not talk further now. There would be time later. Even in the sadness, he could not miss the fact that Mary Black was a big girl now, no longer the mischievous imp who once had been below his lordly notice when he had been a senior at Ladyburg High School. She still had the freckled, laughing face and the prominent, slightly crooked front teeth. But she had grown into a big, wide-hipped, earthy farm girl with a resounding, jolly laugh. She was as tall as Mark's shoulder, and her shape under the thin, threadbare cotton was rounded and full. She had hips and buttocks that swung as she walked beside him, a waist like the flared neck of a vase, and fat, heavy breasts that bounced loosely at each stride. As they walked, she asked questions, endless questions, in a demanding manner, and she kept touching Mark, her hand on his elbow, then grabbing his hand to shake out the answers to her questions, looking up at him with mischievous eyes, laughing her big ringing laugh. Mark felt strangely restless. Fred Black's wife recognized him from across the yard and let out a sound like a milch cow too long deprived of her calf. She had 9 daughters, and she had always pined for a son. "Hello, Aunt Hilda," Mark began, and then was folded into her vast pneumatic embrace. "You're starved," she cried, "and those clothes, they stink. You stink too, Marky. Your hair, you'll be sitting on it next." The 4 unmarried girls, supervised by Mary, set the galvanized bath in the centre of the kitchen floor and filled it with buckets of steaming water from the stove. Mark sat on a stool on the back veranda with a sheet around his shoulders, while Aunt Hilda sheared him of his long curling locks with a huge pair of blunt scissors. Then she drove her daughters protesting from the kitchen. Mark fought desperately for his modesty, but she brushed his defence aside. "An old woman like me? You haven't got anything I haven't seen bigger and better." She stripped him determinedly, hurling the soiled and rumpled clothing through the open doorway to where Mary hovered expectantly. "Wash them, child, and get yourself away from that door." Mark blushed furiously and dropped quickly into the water. In the dusk, Fred Black and Mark sat together on the coping of the well in the yard, with a bottle of brandy between them. The liquor was the fierce Cape smoke, with a bite like a zebra stallion, and after the first sip, Mark did not touch his glass again. "Yes, I've thought about that often," Fred agreed, already slightly owl-eyed with the brandy. "Old Johnny loved that land of his." "Did he ever speak of selling it to you?" "No, never did. I always thought he'd been there forever. Often talked of being buried next to Alice. He wanted that." "When did you last see Grandpa, Uncle Fred?" "Well, now," he rubbed his bald head thoughtfully, "it would be about 2 weeks before he left for Charker's Gate with the Kralings. Yes, that's right, he'd been into Ladyburg to buy cartridges and provisions. Pitched up here one night in the old Scotch cart, and we had a good old chat." "He didn't say anything then, about selling?" "No, not a word." The kitchen door flew open, spilling yellow lantern light into the yard, and Aunt Hilda bellowed at them. "Food's up! Come along now, Fred. Don't you keep that boy out there teaching him your evil ways. And don't you bring that bottle into this house, you hear me?" Fred grimaced, poured the last 3 inches of dark brown liquor into his tumbler and shook his head at the empty bottle. "Farewell, old friend," and sent it sailing over the hedge and drained the tumbler like medicine. Mark was crowded into the bench against the kitchen wall with Mary on one side of him and another of the big buxom daughters on the other. Aunt Hilda sat directly opposite him, shovelling food onto his plate, and loudly berating him if his rate of ingestion faltered. "Fred needs somebody here to help him now. He's getting old, though the old fool doesn't know it." Mark nodded, his mouth so full he was unable to reply, and Mary reached across him for another hunk of home-baked bread that was still warm from the oven. Her big loose breast pressed against Mark, and he almost choked. "The girls don't get much chance to meet nice boys, stuck out here on the farm." Mary shifted in her seat, and her upper thigh came firmly against Mark's. "Leave the lad alone, Hilda, you scheming old woman," Fred slurred amiably from the head of the table. "Mary, give Mark some more gravy on those potatoes." The girl poured the gravy, steadying herself as she leaned over towards Mark by placing her free hand on Mark's leg above the knee. "Eat up. Mary's done you a special milk tart for afters." Mary's hand still rested on his leg, and now it moved slowly but purposefully upwards. Instantly, Mark's entire attention focused on the hand, and the food turned to hot ashes in his mouth.